Blog Talk Radio.
Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, June 17th. We're just about to be officially in summer, a couple of more days. Today we're going to continue our series of shows about World War II with our military historian, blogger, and very good friend of our show, Barry Jacobson. We're going to be looking at the period between 1939 and 41, roughly right after the invasion of Poland and the expansion of Germany. During all of that time, we'll be looking at, of course, Poland itself, the aftermath of that invasion. We're going to be looking at Germany or the Nazis moving into Norway, into Denmark, the fall of France. And then, of course, we're also going to be looking at how all of this is impacting the world. It's an entire continent. You know, Europe is at war in the period that we're going to be covering tonight with our friend Barry Jacobson. And sitting across the Atlantic, the United States, sort of looking at what was happening in Europe and wondering, when are we going to be involved in that? So we'll be getting into all of that with our good friend Barry Jacobson tonight as we look at World War II. This is show number 4, and last weekend I ran the first 3. We put them on Facebook, so maybe you had a chance to listen to one of them, and I'm going to put them on again, at least this one. I'm going to rerun on Sunday afternoon if you don't have a chance to listen to it now or later at Facebook or at Twitter or over in my blog. You know, it's a fascinating series, and we have a fascinating guest, a man who knows a great deal about military history, our friend Barry Jacobson. We're going to take a little break. We're going to hear from one of our sponsors, and then we'll be right back with Barry right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and let's say hello to our good friend Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am doing well, Silvio.
You know, I
prepared for the next installment of our show here.
Yes, and this is a really interesting one because this is a time in the storyline of World War II where maybe people, when they look back, they don't pay that much attention to it because they tend to focus more on the period of America joining the war. But this is, of course, as I mentioned in the introduction, if you were reading a daily newspaper, Barry, at this time, let's say late 1939, 1940, the front pages of all of the capitals of Europe, from Portugal to the Soviet Union, there was war directly or indirectly at each one, or war was being felt directly or indirectly, Barry, at each of the capitals of Europe. And that's a lot of what you're going to get into tonight, Barry.
Yes, that's correct. War had broke out, as we talked about last week, on the 1st of September, 1939, when Hitler invaded Poland. And, of course, within a matter of hours, the British gave them an ultimatum to pull back. And, of course, Hitler ignored the ultimatum, and Germany was soon at war with Britain and France as well. What's interesting to note is that Hitler entered the war unprepared. His generals had told him they needed at least till 1942 and even perhaps a few years beyond that, as late as 1944, before they would be ready for a general war. Hitler was a master opportunist. We've talked about that before. And he had bluffed in the Rhineland in 1936. He had bluffed again in Munich and gotten away with it both times. And both times it came away with territorial concessions from the West. And he thought Poland would be the same thing. He did not plan on war against the West. And, of course, we talked about in the appeasement show that if the Allies had ever shown some backbone, his own generals were ready to overthrow him. They were ready to pull the plug on the Nazi regime. So in 1939, he invades Poland, and it lasts for about 6 weeks. And Poland is overthrown by the German advance. And the Germans use, as we talked about, a new form of warfare based on a new type of formation called the Panzer Division. And this type of warfare is called Blitzkrieg, or lightning warfare. And they were able to overrun Poland with, unfortunately, the help of the Soviets, who they had signed a non-aggression pact with. The Soviets backstabbed Poland midway through the German invasion. So within 1 month and 5 days, the war was over in Poland. And everyone expected that while the Germans were tied down fighting in the east, that the French, who had the largest and strongest army in Europe, reinforced by the British Expeditionary Force of roughly 500,000 men, would attack Germany in the west. And France began a little attack. They began a short advance from their own Maginot Line, which we'll talk about in just a second, against the German defensive line in the west, which was called the Siegfried Line. This was in the Saar region of Germany, right between the French and German border. And only went about 5 miles before they pulled the plug on the offensive and backed off and got back behind their fortifications. Nobody to this day really knows exactly why Gamelin, the French commander-in-chief, decided not to push the attack. But what followed was 8 months of what was called the Sitzkrieg, or the Sitting War in German, or also called the Phony War, where for the next 8 months, the Germans and the French looked at each other over their respective battle lines, one behind the Siegfried Line, the other one behind the Maginot Line, and not much was done. So the war just was sort of in a stalemate for the first 8 months. And largely that was because the weather was bad. Hitler wanted to attack France almost immediately after Poland, as early as October of 1939. But his generals told him that would be impossible. By the time they redeployed their troops from the east to the west, it would be into winter and the mud. Keep in mind, most of the roads of Europe were not paved at this time. They were just dirt roads. So by, when winter sets in and the rains, they turn to mud. So there was no chance of advancing, either side advancing after October of 1939. So that began a period called the Phony War. Meanwhile, Germany, the German generals were frankly trying to come up with a plan whereby they could avoid the same problem they had in 1914 through 1918 during the Great War, World War I, of basically a stalemate in the West. They didn't want to see the same kind of trench warfare develop and have their troops tied down in the West for a prolonged period of time. The best they could come up with under their commander, their chief of staff, Halder, the best plan they come up with was basically a duplication of the so-called Schlieffen Plan from World War I, whereby the German forces would mass against Belgium, and they would swing down through Belgium into northern France. But the Germans weren't stupid, and they knew this wouldn't work. The British and the French would be expecting that. And so they would meet head-on the French and British armies in Belgium, along with the Belgian army, of course. And they would they'd push as far as they could, and then they would dig in. And it was expected to be another 2 years before they could be ready to begin offensive operations in the West again. Well, of course, Hitler looked at this, and that was completely unacceptable. Hitler understood that his peace with the Russians was tentative. And in fact, while he was invading in the West, the Russians were busy attacking into Finland, what was called the Winter War, which we'll talk about on another installment. So about this time, when we're talking about the beginning of 1940, in the early months, a little-known general who was acting as a chief of staff to a higher-ranking general in the West named von Rundstedt, this lesser-known figure was a guy by the name of Erich von Manstein. Von Manstein came up with a plan which would turn the war on its head and completely change the math in the West. This was the so-called Manstein plan, which instead of attacking in strength through the lowlands in Belgium, again duplicating what they had done in World War I, Manstein envisioned massing Germany's 10 panzer divisions. Germany had 10 panzer divisions, their mobile force, and concentrating them instead of spreading them among all the various armies along the frontier. He envisioned massing them at the point where they would be least expected. And this was roughly the middle of the Allied army, or Allied line. It was an area known as the Ardennes Forest. Now, if you think of the geography we're talking about the frontier between Switzerland and the south, moving north through the Franco-German border, which was covered by an intense belt of fortifications, which was known as the Maginot Line on the French side and the Siegfried Line on the German side. This covered Alsace-Lorraine. And then there was the area called the Ardennes Forest, which was a mountainous, wooded area, later would be the scene of the Battle of the Bulge in 1944. And then north of that was the nation of Belgium. Of course, Luxembourg is right there in the Ardennes. And north of Belgium, of course, is the lowlands, swampy area of Holland. So that's the battleground we're talking about. And what Germany had to find a way to do is get around the Maginot Line. The Maginot Line was a dense line of fortifications. Most of them were underground, these forts, heavily manned, backed by artillery, pop-up turrets with cannons on them. A real nightmare to try to get through. And so the French had put a lot of the resources into building this during the 1930s, and their idea was that that would hold the border and allow them to put their maneuver units, their armored and infantry units that weren't manning the Maginot Line, mm-hmm. along with the British forces, into Belgium. Yeah. So, I'm sorry.
Let me ask you. No, I have a couple of quick questions. One is strategy, and the other one is just curiosity. You were talking about the generals. Did they refer, or people at that time refer to the first war as World War I, or is that something that came later? In terms of defining, what did they call the war of the, you know, the first war we call now World War I? What did they call it? Or did it even have a name?
Yes, they called it the Great War.
The Great War, okay.
The Great War. I mean, compared to every war that had come before it, it was the greatest war.
War, the first war. It was, in fact, the World War because it was more, it involved a lot of countries, right? So, but they called it the Great War. I was just trying to establish that. They didn't call it World War I because they didn't know there would be a second one, I guess. That's the answer. Now, but the other question I have about the French line that you're talking about, how difficult is that from a military standpoint to support that many soldiers out there in underground, as you were saying? How difficult is that to support an army like that? I don't know how many soldiers there were, but how difficult is it to keep an army like that going, you know, basically waiting for war that never happens, probably a lot of rain, bad weather. How difficult is that, Barry?
Well, you do it because it's on your own terrain, and the French had trains actually running not only underground in these bunkers and, you know, along these tunnels. The entire Maginot Line was interconnected by tunnels, underground tunnels, because they'd seen during World War I that trench lines were, you know, subject to artillery bombardment when attacked. And, of course, they were, you know, exposed to the elements. So the men basically waded through wet, you know, muddy trenches through most of the war. So the Maginot Line was all concrete. It was below ground, but it was all reinforced concrete tunnels. There were even train tracks laid inside them. And ultimately, all the supplies could come from the interior of France to the Maginot Line. So supplying them wasn't difficult. What would have been difficult is assaulting it. And that's what the Germans wanted to avoid. So getting back to the plan, this guy, Erich von Manstein, his plan was to break through at Sedan, right through the town of Sedan, which is right on the Meuse River, and it's the hinge point between the Maginot Line and to the south and the mobile French and British forces that would be operating in Belgium. And by piercing that point with armored forces, he envisioned rolling up, breaking through and rolling up the French line to the south and the British and French lines to the north. Well, the generals looked at that and they were appalled. And they didn't even give the plan to Hitler to look at. In fact, they fired Manstein and sent him back to Poland to take over some garrison unit. But something happened to change the whole equation when the German plan for the invasion of France, which is called Case Yellow, in January, a plane carrying the plan crash-landed in French territory. And the French were able to see the plan and prepare for it. And, of course, it was what they expected anyway. So that forced the general staff to come up with something else. And about the same time, some of Manstein's adherents brought their plan directly to the Führer, to Adolf Hitler. And this was exactly what he wanted to see. You know, he did not want to see a repetition of World War One, a war that he had fought in, and was, you know, just one giant stalemate, one, in fact, which Germany would lose. And the generals were sure, Germany, by the way, we're going to lose this war. We're unprepared for it. They could see no way of breaking through the French and the British, who outnumbered them. You know, the French had 2 million men facing the Germans, with another 500,000 British forces. They had a total of 104 French divisions, 13 British divisions, and another roughly 32 or 33 Belgian and Dutch divisions, against a mere 93 German divisions, 10 of which were panzer. As far as tanks go, you know, the Allies had an advantage in just about every category. They had 7,000 cannon to the, they had 13,000 cannon to the German 7,000, almost a 2-to-1 advantage in artillery. They had half again as many tanks as the Germans. The only place they really were outnumbered was an aircraft. The Luftwaffe, the German Luftwaffe, was larger than the Allied forces, almost by 2-to-1, which would play a huge part in the battle to come. So the Germans were planning to do the unexpected by attacking with armored forces through terrain that supposedly couldn't support armored forces. This is the mountainous, heavily wooded Ardennes, which is why the French weren't expecting it, of course, because no one was supposed to be able to move tanks to that terrain. So fast forward. In 1940, in April, Germany begins the offensive by attacking Norway. This is the first of the Blitzkriegs. German forces move by sea through Denmark, by land, and then through sea, crossing the channel there. They invade Norway. And the reason is because they're going to need Norway later on as a base for submarine warfare into the North Atlantic. Otherwise, they'd find their navy bottled up basically in the Baltic Sea. This will allow them to break out of the Baltic Sea by occupying Norway, using the fjords as subpens, essentially, and allow the U-boats to operate, you know, into the North Atlantic, with the ultimate purpose, of course, to cutting off British supplies from their colonies to Great Britain. You know, the submarines would then sink the supplies. This is something, by the way, that was very successful during World War One. It very nearly brought Britain to its knees. And the only reason it failed is because it actually brought the United States into the war with the sinking of the Lusitania. So in a lightning campaign in which the British oppose unsuccessfully, Norway is overrun. The entire campaign goes from 9 April to 10 June, about 62 days. And the Germans occupy Norway. And that prepares the way for the Battle of France. The French are lined up in mass. Again, they outnumber the Germans, and they have every expectation of stopping them in Belgium. But the Germans have got a secret plan, and this is the Manstein plan, the plan to attack the Ardennes. So in 1940, June, May 10th, Case Yellow begins. It begins with a parachute drop by a battalion of German paratroopers called Fallschirmjägers, sky hunters is what it means. And they parachute onto the Belgian fortress of Oppenheimel. This is a fortress that is right at the town of Liege, right on the German-Belgian border. In World War One, it held out for 12 days. It was a very powerful fortress. And it really delayed the German advance into Belgium in 1914 by 12 days. The Germans took it in one day, took it in a single attack by a very audacious airborne landing, the first of its kind in the entire war. Actually, one of the first of its kind in history, using gliders. Gliders land on the roof of this fortification, and the Germans, using flamethrowers and grenades, then flush out the defenders and kill them, opening the way for the advance into Belgium.
Now, let me ask you a question about that. Give me for a second. Let me just ask you a couple of quick questions. I remember when we did our series about World War One, that you were telling us that the generals or everybody thought the war would be over real quick, that it would just be one of these quick wars and everybody would go home. Did the generals think that also in World War Two, or were they in for the longer run?
No, quite the opposite. In World War One, the Schlieffen Plan was meant to envelop northern France and capture Paris within the first few months. And the Germans envisioned knocking France out of the war within 6 weeks, 2 months at the most, and then turning their armies against the Russians, who were at the very time advancing through Poland, which was Russian territory, and then into East Prussia, which was German territory. So in World War I, 1914, the Germans had every expectation of rapid victory over the French. The opposite is true in 1940. The German generals were very pessimistic. They didn't trust the Manstein plan. The German generals thought that it would be the death of the Panzer Corps, that the 10 Panzer divisions, 8 of which would be concentrated opposite the Ardennes for a drive through in the middle, that these would be cut off fairly easily. You think of it as mountainous terrain with high hills, narrow roads, heavily wooded. They didn't think it would take much for French infantry units to infiltrate into that area and set up roadblocks or ambush positions and ambush supply convoys. So the Germans might break through, but their supply lines would be stretched through the Sardines forest, and that would become a death trap for supply lines as French began to operate against it. Kind of exactly what happened in the Battle of the Bulge. You know, the Americans took up defensive positions in the hills. So they were very pessimistic. And keep in mind, these are the guys who never really believed Hitler to begin with.
Right.
They've just come around to start to believe in it. But this whole plan seems very risky to the German generals.
But let me ask you a question about that, and then we'll take a break. The fact that they were so pessimistic or didn't think that, you know, or thought the losses would be very high, is that the reason that they were so creative? Because what you're describing, the attack of the Germans, was something we had never seen before. And usually, you know, it sounds to me like the German generals were being very creative and trying to come up with something the French had never seen. It's sort of like, you know, a football team. You're trying to come up with a play the other guy have not seen before. Is that what the German generals were thinking? And then we'll take a quick break.
Yes. By German generals, you mean von Manstein. Yes.
Yeah, the Manstein, ones making the calls, yeah.
Yeah, Manstein, by the way, was aided by a subordinate commander who would be commanding the spearhead units of the tanks, the Spearhead Panzer Corps. His name was Heinz Guderian. We talked about him last week. Guderian was the father of German Blitzkrieg. He's often called the father of Panzer warfare. He's the one who came up with most of the revolutionary theories and experimented in the 1930s with the Panzer Division, the creation of the Panzer Division. And he was under Manstein's command, and he and Manstein came up with this plan together. And they were confident it would work. But you hit around the nail, Silvio, that, you know, you have to become creative when all else fails. All conventional answers to the problem had been, you know, experimented with in World War One. They were going to try it again in World War Two, and the only difference would be that they had now, you know, tanks leading the infantry. But strategically, if they tried the same thing they did in World War One, it would have failed for the same reasons. There's just not enough space to maneuver, masses of men, and you end up, you know, butting heads directly with your enemy and a head-on attack, and that's easily stopped. So no one had any confidence in this plan except the two guys who came up with it,
right?
And Hitler, who gave him the green light. Hitler thought it would work.
Right. Well, let's take a little break, Barry. And when I come back, I'll ask you a question, but from the French perspective, what they were thinking. We'll be right back with our friend Barry Jacobson, and this is our fourth episode of World War II. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we're chatting with our good friend Barry Jacobson. We're looking at World War II. We're roughly in 1940. And let me ask you a quick question, Barry, about the French. Now, the Germans were making a play. What was the French reaction, as best as you could tell, what was the French reaction when they saw that German attack that had never been done before? What was their reaction?
Well, the Allied plan initially was called the Dyle Plan. It was an advance to the Dyle River in Belgium, which runs roughly north and south, perpendicular to the German line of advance. So they were going to advance this river line and then entrench and force the Germans to attack them against across a very strong position. The initial attack on May 10th developed, the first thrust by the Germans was against Abbeville, as we just talked about, the Belgian fort. And the Army Group A, the northern forces of the German army that were opposite Belgium, began advancing into Belgium. And that sold the plan because it was a sort of a feint. It gave the British and the French the idea that, yes, indeed, they're attacking in force to Belgium, just what we expect. And so they, along with the Belgian defenders, they prepared to defend themselves. Meanwhile, the Dutch in the north are doing the same thing as Germans advanced into Holland as well. But then Gamelin realized very quickly that the Germans were coming out to Ardennes Forest in mass and attacking the Meuse River line near Sedan. And he wasn't terribly worried at that time because he had reserves to get thrown in there to plug the line if they broke through. And generally speaking, tank divisions have a very tough time crossing rivers. You know, tanks don't swim. At least back then, in those days, they don't. Nowadays, we do have amphibious tanks, but back then, they just sink. Right. And so the Germans had only one way of getting them across, and it's build a bridge. So building a bridge in the face of artillery fire and defenders on the opposite side of the river with machine guns and massed infantry, even though there wasn't a great deal of defenders, there were some, is a pretty difficult, daunting proposition. So Gamelin initially was not too worried. However, he didn't factor in Germany's massive air force and air advantage in the battle. Hermann Göring had promised, the commander of the Luftwaffe, Fat Göring, had promised that he would support the attack on Sedan by Guderian's panzer forces as they tried to cross with massive air assault. Now, here's a guy that almost throughout the entire of World War II, as we're going to see, never lives up to his promises. He always overpromises and underdelivers. But in this case, Göring actually came through. The Luftwaffe delivered a massive and sustained shock and awe attack on the French forces from the air using Stuka dive bombers for the most part, supported by fighter aircraft, flying close air support, and combat air patrols overhead. And the Germans had something that the French didn't have. They had two things the French didn't have, which really helped them here. One was they had forward air controllers. They were the first ones to pioneer this. This is something we do, every day now, and we would never think of not having these. But this was brand new in World War II, where you'd have Luftwaffe observers on the ground riding in half tracks with the armored forces, the armored spearheads. And these guys would be able to contact by radio the planes overhead and call in airstrikes, which is a tremendous force multiplier, as we call it today.
Right. We do this all the time, don't we? I mean, we did this in Iraq all the time. I mean, this is almost like, I didn't realize, so the Germans actually started this practice?
That's right. The Germans pioneered this practice.
Wow.
Keep in mind, as we talk about World War II, that everything we do today, the entire air-land battle, as we call it, the use of combined arms, artillery, tanks, infantry, air, all supporting each other. All that was brand new in World War II. It had never been seen before. And it was all pioneered by the British, or by the Germans. The Germans began all this.
Wow.
And that's why they did so well early in the war.
Right. Did they by any chance test this particular tactic during the Spanish Civil War?
Well, that's exactly right. You've obviously done the reading here, haven't you?
Oh, I try a little bit.
Yes.
I like to prepare myself for your show. I mean, I just kind of like to ask you a good question from time to time, you know.
I appreciate that. Yeah, well, that's exactly right. The Spanish Civil War was where the Germans prepared, you know, for the coming war. So, you know, with this massive sustained bombardment, the French defenses behind the Meuse River at Sedan were overwhelmed with this shock and awe attack. And Guderian was able to throw up bridges and to get his panzers across without the French being able to counterattack. At that point, the high command, German high command, once again got the jitters. And they thought, well, this is advancing way too rapidly. Keep in mind that most of the German army was still marching on foot. There was only 10 panzer divisions compared to the overall, you know, 3 million German forces, 90 divisions, only 10 of which were panzer. So most of the infantry is still far to the rear, you know, marching forward. Now, each panzer division has its own integral infantry, artillery, and artillery support. But the masses of artillery are still horse-drawn. You know, these are the artillery formations that follow the infantry divisions. So these guys are slogging out way in the rear, and the high command says, slow down. Wait till the infantry catch up to you. It might take a few days. We want you to cross the river and just dig in on the other side and hold a bridgehead. And Guderian's going to have none of this. So Guderian wheedles a order from his higher commander, permission to carry out what's called reconnaissance in force, meaning he's able to probe the enemy defenses and just kind of see what's out there. Don't really advance, but just send some scouts. Well, of course, his scouts are the entire corps. His entire Panzer Corps advances rapidly into enemy territory and begins maneuvering towards English Channel. Now, why is English Channel important? Well, the British draw all their supplies from English Channel, from the ports along the channel, from Dunkirk, Boulogne. Those are the major ports, and Guderian aims his panzers right for them. At this time, the British and the French are advancing to the Dire River, planning to fight the Germans in Belgium, when suddenly, to the south of them, the Germans have busted through a Sedan and are driving just at breakneck speed, right for the English Channel. And this not only threatens the British line of retreat and line of supply, but also cuts off the French from their line of supply. The French forces of Belgium draw their supply from France. And as the Germans drive across from east to west towards the English Channel, they are cutting off the French army in Belgium, which, of course, spells disaster. And that is how the Battle of France quickly degenerates into a debacle, or debacle, if you will, for the Allied forces. Within a matter of weeks, the Germans have cut off all the Allied forces in the north. They've isolated the Maginot Line. They've kind of left it alone, but they've got an army under von Lieb just keeping an eye on it. And the panzers are driving towards English Channel. Everything is...
So when do the... Go ahead and finish. I have a question for you. But when do the Germans walk into France? There's this great picture of the Germans walking into France on horseback, you know, really intimidating.
Right.
Was that about to happen, or were coming
up? That's
or?
About to happen. That's coming
okay.
up. We're still talking about the cutting off their forces. They haven't driven south into France yet. They actually are right along the northern part of France, pretty much the same terrain they fought in World War I. And Guderian, by the way, had been in World War I, and he knew the terrain well. And they're driving towards English Channel, and this is the step one. At that point, the British begin pulling back towards Dunkirk, where they have to evacuate, if necessary, from France. The whole plan is falling apart. And meanwhile, General Gamelin is replaced by General Wegen. Wegen is his second in command, and Wegen takes command of the French army. The hapless Gamelin is replaced. And Wegen's plan is then to attack the German thrust, the panzer thrust, from north and south in a pincher movement to cut it off, which is a good plan, except that by the time the French get around to doing it, the German infantry have finally caught up, and they're beginning to file through the salient at Sedan and occupy that breach in the lines and keep it open. Keep the breach open and keep the panzers under Guderian supplied. By the way, one of the guys who's also in that
thrust to the shore, commanding the 7th Panzer Division, is a guy by the name of Erwin Rommel.
Oh, yes.
Rommel will soon be Germany's most famous general.
Mm-hmm.
But he is, at this point, commander of the 7th Division, and his division, operating on the forward edge of the battle, advances so rapidly towards Normandy that the British call it the Ghost Division, because every time they get a reading, get a report that the 7th Panzer is in one place, it disappears, and it's somewhere else by the next report. It seems to disappear and reappear like a ghost, and meanwhile doing inflicting tremendous damage on the British as a ghost. So everything's falling apart, and the British at this point make the decision, which the French, by the way, consider a backstab, of evacuating what's left of their army. Now, they've taken some fairly strong casualties by this point, fighting along the Dal River, and they're about to be cut off. They've got to get back to Dunkirk, which is the port through which they're supplied, and through which they have to evacuate if they need to pull out of there. And so what follows is what's called the Miracle of Dunkirk. From 27th of May through the 4th of June, 1940, the British Expeditionary Force, roughly 338,000 men, are evacuated from the beaches. And they're evacuated not by naval transport, but by civilian craft for the most part. You know, the call goes out, and British yachtsmen and fishermen rush to cross the English Channel to Dunkirk, about a one-day sail across the channel. And they begin in dribs and drabs evacuating all the troops they can from the beaches back to England. And the troops leave their equipment behind because it's just too heavy to haul tanks and artillery and so on. But the troops largely are evacuated. And one of the great mysteries of World War II is why the Germans don't overrun Dunkirk and stop this. Instead, Hitler calls a halt, a second halt to the Panzers when Guderian is approaching Dunkirk. And for a week, the Germans do nothing but just watch as the British withdraw. No one really knows why, Silvio, that the Germans allowed the British Expeditionary Force to withdraw. It'll have a crucial effect on the continuation of the war, because without those trained troops, Britain would have had a very tough time.
Right.
In the battles to come.
Right. But one quick question, Barry. Was that typical of Hitler micromanaging, or was that an exception?
It will become typical. At this point, it's not. Hitler, as time goes on, Hitler will begin to think that he knows better than his generals. His generals didn't want to trust Manstein and the Manstein plan. He did. Mm-hmm. The plan worked. So that begins to begins him to think that maybe I know better than they do.
Right.
And this will happen throughout the war. Eventually, we'll get to the point where, as we'll see by 1942, mm-hmm. Hitler will begin taking overall command of the entire German army and micromanaging it from Berlin or
right.
from his headquarters in East Prussia.
And not enjoying a lot of success, as we will see later on. So when does France, since we're getting close to the end here, when does France actually fall? What month in 1940?
It falls in June. The Battle of France ends in June. The campaign is indeed a real blitzkrieg.
Mm-hmm.
1 month and 15 days after the Battle of France begins, on June 25th, it ends with the French capitulation.
And this is when the German army makes that dramatic entry into Paris, right? These amazing pictures of the German soldiers on horseback, I mean, looking like...
It'll be marching under the Arc de Triomphe. We have,
exactly,
German
but I mean, looking very much like a conquering army, if you were going to... picture an army conquering, those Germans certainly had that look of on that picture, didn't they, Barry?
Well, and that is on 14 June 1940, the Germans enter Paris, which is surrendered.
Right.
And France collapses. Now, France has colonies throughout the world. There's colonies
mm-hmm.
in Africa. There's colonies in Southeast Asia. They will continue to fight on.
Right.
But ultimately, the French, after the surrender, northern France will become part of the Third Reich, directly ruled by the Germans. That will include Paris. But a rump government will be established in Vichy, in the south of France. It'll be called Vichy France, and it'll collaborate with the Germans until the coming of when the Americans finally enter the war and Vichy is done away with by the Germans. But de Gaulle, who will become a famous figure both at the end of the war and in post-war years, Charles de Gaulle, flees from France. He was commanding one of the French armored units and becomes a national hero by continuing the struggle, commanding what's called the Free French Forces that will fight with the British. Now, if I may play something, about this time, Britain, after evacuating their soldiers, undergoes a change of command. The guy who had been the mastermind of appeasement, Neville Chamberlain, resigns as prime minister. And Chamberlain is replaced by his first Lord of the Admiralty, a politician who had steadfastly been opposed to appeasing the Nazis from the very beginning. And, of course, we know him as Sir Winston Churchill. Churchill had been a figure in World War I. He had been disgraced after the Battle of Gallipoli, and he spent the post-war years after World War I pretty much in the political wilderness. But he came back into politics in the late 30s as an opponent of the Nazis, warning his country that Hitler was the proverbial wolf at their door. And so when Chamberlain resigns, Churchill becomes Prime Minister of England. And it's just as the Battle of France is ending and the Battle of Britain, which will be the German plan to invade Britain and the attempt to do so, is about to begin. So I'm just going to play, if you will, Winston Churchill's initial speech on that.
No, please do. Please do.
There you have it. Upon this, I cut it a little short. He said, upon this, the fate of civilization rests. The
right.
Battle of France has ended. The Battle of Britain is about to begin.
Right. Churchill, of course, is one of the great personalities, not just of British history, but of world history, a man that I'm always fascinated by. By 1940, a lot of people don't realize this, but 1940, he was 66, I believe, 66 years old. And so, I mean, that's we usually don't think of people becoming prime minister at that age, but he was 66, and just an amazing human being. I would say the to me one of the great citizens of the 20th century. Where would you rank him, Barry? I mean, I have to think in terms of the English speaking people. I would have to think two or three. Don't you think?
Yeah, I'd say he's, without a doubt, the greatest prime minister in British history.
Yes.
He's certainly the most literate. He was a magnificent writer and speechmaker. He had a great speaking style, and he was an incredibly inspirational figure. But then in the 20th century, he stands out as the giant of statesmen in the 20th century.
That's right.
Roosevelt was a great figure. Stalin was in his own way, was a great figure. Of course, Hitler was probably the most instrumental and mover and shaker in that he, basically the whole world danced to his tunes. You know, we have World War II because of Hitler. But Hitler was a terrible statesman. And Churchill, with far less resources, was able to thwart him, largely because of the power of his own will.
No, he was an amazing, amazing human being. And, by the way, there's a great picture, a great movie about Winston. This is young Winston. I guess it goes up to the time that he marries Clementine, who would become his wife and first lady of Britain. Great movie called Young Winston. It has nothing to do with the war, but it's a great movie. They were showing it. They were showing it the other day. Just an absolutely great movie. So our next chapter in the timeline is the Battle of Britain itself, Barry.
That's right, and this is the turning point. What Churchill will call, Churchill phrased it beautifully. He said, "This is not the beginning of the end, but it is the end of the beginning."
Wow.
And that's exactly what it was.
Yes, And all this time, the United States is watching this from across the Atlantic. We were having an election, by the way, in 1940, when Franklin Roosevelt ran for the third term, and he was being accused by the Republicans that he wanted to, you know, engage the United States in what they used to call the European War. And he basically ran, saying, I'm not going to send troops to war. So it was an issue in our 1940 presidential election. And, of course, not much later, it would become a big issue with the attack on Pearl Harbor. So we're going to be covering, the next time, we'll be talking about Britain, 1940, 1941, that time period.
That's right. And we will, if we don't get to it next installment, we'll get to the following installment when we get to the Desert Fox, who in 1940,
yes,
Erwin Rommel takes command of the German forces in an effort to break into Egypt and take over North Africa.
Let me ask you a question that we may not have time to get into it today, so let's think about it for next time. But World War One and World War Two had a lot of people who were soldiers in one and then were let's say, politicians or leaders the next. Truman, for example, was a sergeant in World War One, was the president of the United States and a key member of the Senate in World War Two. Eisenhower, the same way. You mentioned Rommel, I think, also. We may not have time to answer it, but has that ever happened before in world history where people fought in this war and then led their countries in a war soon after? Is that something that has happened before in your mind, Barry?
Not to my knowledge, not to the scale that you see here.
Because here we're talking 20 years. Deal. I mean, basically, we're talking 20 years here. We're talking 1918 and 1939, roughly. So if you were 20 or 25 and you were a soldier, you would be a man in your 40s or your 50s. You could see that, but I don't know if this has ever happened in any other war before. I mean, it's just a real curiosity of this war is how it connected people's lives. You know, Truman, the best example. A man who saw service in World War One, and then, of course, was the one who had to decide about the dropping the atomic bomb, Barry.
Well, the one example that does come to mind, and of course, we're not talking about ancient times. There were plenty of examples in ancient times, but George Washington was a colonel of colonial militia from Virginia who fought in the French Indian Wars in the 1750s. Mm. And then later, of course, took command of the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War, during the 1770s and 1780s, and during the Revolution. That's an example of what we're talking about, but never to the wide scale that we're talking about here. You know, because again, there's such a short time frame between the wars,
right.
And then again, you have a war where you have so much going on, you know, so many different nations of war, so many fields of conflict. Rommel was a decorated hero from the First World War. He had commanded a regiment during the war. Patton had commanded our only armored brigade in World War One. He would become our best tank commander in World War Two.
Mm-hmm.
MacArthur commanded forces in World War One. There were plenty of commanders who served in both wars, first as junior commanders, relative junior, and then later as senior commanders. And of course, Churchill was first Lord of the Admiralty in World War One and then became Prime Minister in World War Two.
Right, and I'm thinking of a recent example, Barry, Vietnam and the Gulf War. Colin Powell served in Vietnam and, of course, was the top military man in the Gulf War. That was about
Captain
a 25-year span. That's right.
Yeah, Stroman Norman was a World War,
right.
A Vietnam War vet as well.
Yeah, so but that was 25 years apart, whereas World War II, well, was 20 years of difference. But anyway, so we'll get into the Battle of Britain the next time, Barry. As always, thank you for your time. Just completely fascinating listening to you and admiring your knowledge of history. I always work real hard to come up with a good question to keep up with your intellect on these on these shows. But
I appreciate it. Keeps me on my toes. That way, I just don't drone on.
That's right. Well, you have a great
answer
weekend.
Your question.
Yes. Well, you always do. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you the next time, Barry. Thank you so much for your time.
And you're quite welcome. Take care.
All right. Barry Jacobson, our great friend, military historian. We have a link to his website. He has a blog. He writes about history. Just an absolutely, absolutely wonderful guy. Well, that's it. We'll probably do Chapter 5 next week, so tune in for that. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.